Well, Paul, of course, writes because he's thankful to the Christians in Rome. He's thankful that there are Christians in Rome. We don't know how big the church was. We don't know for certain. But nevertheless, he makes it clear that he's keen to travel there so that he can be with the other Christians. He thanks God for them, delighted the fact that God has saved others. I often wonder whether we do that sufficiently enough. Do we thank God for one another? I thank God for nice Christians. I'm not sure about the others, though. You know, for the ones that annoy me, I'm not sure that I should thank God for those. But I have this horrible feeling that God, who has a great sense of humour, if I don't thank God for them now, he'll put them next to me at the great table and I'll have to like them in heaven. So if you have a list of people that you prefer not to spend time with in heaven, you can be certain he'll be sitting at your table. And so we should thank God for one another. We are brothers and sisters. I remember when all my brothers were excited when my little sister was born. And trouble was, she grew up and became difficult. We weren't quite so excited about it at that point. But we were excited to have someone else in the family, and that's the way we should be. He wants to build them up, and he wants to be built up by them. You can see quite a change there in Paul. There's a sort of humility. You know, he says, I want to come to teach you a few things, but I also recognize that I will learn much from you. And, of course, one of the things that certainly I've discovered, and in fact the only reason I'm a minister is because God can't teach me anything unless I have to actually learn enough to teach you guys. So being a minister actually is a wonderful way of learning. But we should all be ministers. We should all be wanting to help people to grow in their faith. And the more we give out, the more God is prepared to give us. You know, I remember years ago people talking about the Dead Sea Christian. You know, the Dead Sea is dead and salty and nothing lives in it because lots of water runs into it, but none runs out. It's a taker but not a giver. And, of course, it's really important that we take things in and we share it with other people in whatever situation that you find yourself in. And if you do that, you'll find you'll grow and you'll get a passion for wanting to learn more and more. And so he wants their faith to grow. He wants to experience growth in his own faith. And it's an incredible difference, you know, when you think about Paul. This was the Paul who was so keen on killing Christians just a few years before, and now he's one who wants to share his life with them. It's an amazing change. But in the passage, and in fact the whole of Romans, Paul talks a lot about faith because he's discovered faith. He's discovered that this is the key to salvation. And when you discover that, you know, when your eyes are finally opened, it is a wonderful experience, and it's something that you really get a great deal of joy in sharing with other people who have had similar experiences. All right, and that's true for lots of other things too. I remember a few years ago I went scuba diving, and because I'm old and you can probably already tell my lungs are not brilliant, and also my heart's not the best either, so I could never take it on as a full-time thing. But I do remember Jules and I went scuba diving in Queensland, and I remember floating around, you know, with a fish and saying to myself, all the years that I've not been scuba diving have been a total waste. You know, I felt like Toad of Toad Hall, you know. And, you know, Toad of Toad Hall, and everything he did, he thought, oh, I wasted my previous life not driving a car, etc. So I felt very much like that in a sense. And the simple fact is, if I'd have taken on scuba diving, I'd want to be with other people who have discovered the beauty of it, what a wonderful thing it is to be able to float around with a fish and all that kind of stuff. And that's what struck Paul. And the beautiful thing about it is that Paul didn't just get there because he was raised in the right family. It was a real struggle for him doing things the wrong way, so that when he finally found out the right way, it was such a joy. And you see a sense of that in Philippians chapter 3, verses 1 to 8. Let me read that to you. Finally, my brothers, rejoice in the Lord. It is no longer trouble for me to write the same things to you again, and it is a safeguard for you. Watch out for those dogs, those men who do evil, those mutilators of the flesh. In other words, the ones who demand that everyone gets circumcised. For it is we who are the circumcision. It is we who worship the Spirit of God, who glory in Christ Jesus and put no confidence in the flesh, or if you like, no confidence in our own abilities. though I myself have reasons for such confidence, if anyone else thinks he has reasons to put confidence in the flesh, I have more. Circumcised on the eighth day of the people of Israel, of the tribe of Benjamin, a Hebrew of Hebrews, in regard to the law, a Pharisee. As for zeal, persecuting the church, as for legalistic righteousness, I was faultless. But whatever was to my profit then, I now consider loss for the sake of Christ. What is more, I consider everything loss compared to the surpassing greatness of knowing Jesus Christ my Lord, for whose sake I have lost all things. I consider them rubbish. And in fact, if we weren't so gentlemanly, we would translate it, I consider them crap, that I may gain Christ. In other words, everything I thought was so vitally important, all my struggles to find peace with God, you know, everything I had invested in, everything that gave me, in a sense, purpose and status with other people, I am prepared to put aside and see it as a total waste in comparison to the discovery that I could have it all as a free gift from Jesus Christ. And so he discovers the total absurdity of trying to satisfy God by one's own efforts and the incredible joy of realizing that he no longer has to try, that he has to accept what Jesus has done for him. And it's this discovery which drives him to serve God in the preaching of his gospel. So when he talks about the power that the gospel has for salvation, for people who believe, he knows what that's about. He has a personal experience of that. And because of that powerful personal experience, he just can't help himself but go out and preach the gospel. So it's all about faith. It's putting faith in what Jesus has done for him. But I want to talk in general terms about faith. And the reason I want to do that is because in the current debate, one of the really sad things, can I say, is that when you go to university these days, it's far too specialised. So if you do science, that's what you do. And in fact, in some countries, that's all you do. In Kazakhstan, for example, you go to a university of science, or you go to a university of commerce, or you go to a university of literature. You know, have separate universities for these things. It's far too specialised. And the reason that I think that's a problem is there was a time once when you had a general education. You may have majored in a particular subject. I remember I went to Macquarie University and I majored in economics, but I had to do quite a number of other subjects to give me a nice rounded understanding of the way the world is. So I did some law and some science and a few other things like that. And because this has happened, you know, you get scientists saying the most absurd things these days. And denying the role of other disciplines in understanding the world that they live in. And that's really sad. And so just to quote a few things that our friend Richard Dawkins says, for example, he says, faith is the great cop-out, the great excuse to evade the need to think and evaluate evidence. Faith is belief in spite of, even perhaps because of, the lack of evidence. He then goes on to say, dyed-in-the-wool faith heads, that's us, are immune to argument. Faith is a process of non-thinking, which is evil precisely because it requires no justification and brooks no argument. And then he really gets nasty, and he says this. He says that religion is a cop-out, a betrayal of the intellect, a betrayal of all that's best about what makes us human, a phony substitute for an explanation which seems to answer the question until you examine it and realize it does no such thing. Religion in science is not just redundant and irrelevant, it's an active and pernicious charlatan. It peddles false explanations, or at least pseudo-explanations, where real explanations could have been offered and will be offered. Pseudo-explanations that get in the way of the enterprise of discovering real explanations. As the centuries go by, religion has less and less room to exist and perform its obscurantist interference with the search for truth. In the 21st century, it's high time finally to send it packing. Now, it's interesting, and these things are worthy of examining, because the statements are actually riddled with faith. For example, he has to have faith to believe that science says it all, that science has the ability to describe and explain everything, leaving nothing for the other disciplines to describe. And you can only believe that by faith. The second thing is, and this is quite dangerous and quite unscientific in a sense, it's faith to believe that science won't provide irrefutable evidence for the existence of God in the future. Now, the evidence is really mounting up. I heard someone say just recently that you get rid of a hypothesis when the anomaly is as such that you've got nothing to hang on to. And Stephen Meyer, who is incredibly intelligent, both science and philosophy, answered, he said, we're well and truly past that with Darwinism. There are so many anomalies that we really ought to dump it. It cannot stand up to all these anomalies. The third thing, of course, is that he has faith that we as humans have the capacity to examine the results of any inquiry, including science, and actually get it right. That's an act of faith. We take it for granted, but it's still an act of faith. I think this quote, I'm not quite sure whose it was, but I think it sums it up nicely. He says, to use the language of philosophy, God is the best explanation for the way things are. We can't prove that God is there any more than the atheist can prove that there is no God. But all of us, whether Christian or atheist, base our lives on at least some fundamental beliefs that we know we cannot prove. That's just the way things are. And so faith really features in every aspect of our lives, in even the most simple things in our lives. Sometimes we think it only applies to the extreme things. And I remember when I was first doing Christianity Explained, which is a series of, some of you have done it, it's a series of six or seven studies to explain the nature of Christianity. The first three talk about Jesus and the last three talk about faith and repentance and things like that. And on the subject of faith, they had this illustration about a Frenchman who used to walk a tightrope over Niagara Falls. He was an amazing character. I mean, it was a true story, or some of it was true. I don't know whether some of it might have been exaggerated or not. His name, I think, was James Blondin. His surname was certainly Blondin. And so this was the illustration for faith, that James Blondin could ride a push bike on a tightrope across Niagara Falls. He could even push people in a wheelbarrow across Niagara Falls, and he could do all these marvellous things. And on one occasion, a member of the press came up to him and said, you're amazing, James, that you can push the wheelbarrow across. And so James said, well, if you really think I'm amazing, get in the wheelbarrow. And he did. And he did. Now, it's a great illustration, but unfortunately, it really gives us a wrong view of faith, in a sense. I mean, certainly you would need faith to do that. But the simple fact is we need faith for everything. Even the very simple things. Like, for example, I'm about to let this key go. What do you think is going to happen? It's going to fall. So is that faith or fact? Well, the thing is that, you know, it's faith. But, of course, it's faith based on good evidence, extremely good evidence, in fact. I believe that those keys will fall on the basis of good evidence. That's what faith is. When you came to church this morning, you got in a car. Most of you, I suppose. Might have been a couple of you walked. Might have even been a couple that walked. Now, it was an act of faith. I mean, when I go to put food in my mouth, that's an act of faith that I'm not going to poison myself or something of that nature, that it will, in fact, be tasty and be good for me. Everything we do, even the most simple things in life, are ultimately an act of faith. And so if you tell me a story, then I have to exercise faith to believe that what you've told me is true. Or if I see one of your photographs, there you are in Rome or England or somewhere and doing a little selfie, there's your picture and there's behind you is the Eiffel Tower, I've got to believe that you were really there. It's an act of faith. I mean, these days you can Photoshop it, make it look very good. So the faith is used in just everything that we do. I have to have faith in the research of others. I have to have faith when I read a book, whether it be about history, about science, or about anything. I have to believe, I have to decide to trust that what that book is telling me is true. And I also have to believe that that my understanding of what is said in the book or whatever is also true. So I need to have faith in ideas and theories. I have to have faith in the things that people have taught me at school. And so there's everything I need faith for. You see, it's a very common thing. All of our life, we need those kinds of things. Now, it's true, of course, that there are some things that we have extremely good evidence for. In fact, the evidence is so great that we can almost say it was proven. Almost say it was proven, you see. But there are other things that we take on trust, on the balance of probabilities. In fact, I think most of what we do in life is on the balance of probabilities. What C.S. Lewis says is very, very helpful here. He says, I believe in Christianity as I believe that the sun has risen, not only because I see it, but because by it I see everything else. In other words, what the Christian faith has done for me, and I hope it's done for you, is giving you a God's world view of everything. And as Christians, that ought to be developing over time. Now, the other thing is the faith we have as Christians is meant to be rational and reasonable. You know, sometimes Christians can be as silly as the atheists, that they believe somehow it takes greater faith to believe in something that's really quite ridiculous, which is not the way it's meant for the Christian faith. You see, the heart cannot exalt in what the mind rejects. Let me say that again. The heart cannot exalt in what the mind rejects. Or, if you like to put it another way, the heart cannot exalt in what the mind is suspicious about. And so it's incredibly important for us to understand that we must struggle, you know, with our belief system in order to settle things in our mind. Let me say to you, one of the worst things that can happen for you as a Christian is that you have certain doubts and you don't express them to other Christians, or you don't look them up in other books or do something to deal with those doubts. You know, I say to people who come to my office that everything that God tells us is true. He doesn't tell us everything, of course. There's some things that are left as mysteries. But everything that he tells us is true. And any reasonable question that you have about life, God has a rational answer for. But you have to be willing sometimes to struggle with it, as you do to struggle with anything that you want to believe. So it's incredibly important. The heart cannot exalt. In other words, you can't feel comfortable within yourself if your mind does not agree with what you see. Incredibly important. And so we do not say that by faith 3 and 3 equals 10. That's an irrational view of things. And what the writer of Hebrews says when he defines faith and gives examples of it, I think are marvellous. There are two verses, very powerful. The first one is chapter 11, verse 3. He says, by faith we understand that the universe was formed at God's command, so that what is seen was not made out of what was visible. And nobody, that's a perfect statement to explain why there is something rather than nothing at all. Perfect statement, cannot be improved on. You know, everything we see is the result of something that we cannot see. The amount of faith or trust or belief you have in something depends on whether you have a good reason to believe. So the more senses it appeals to, the more you're likely to believe it. So if I walk into a house and I see a bowl full of fruit, and in that bowl there is an apple, I see it with my eyes. It looks like an apple, but is it an apple? They do make, you know, incredibly good ones out of plastic these days. So I have good reasons by seeing it with my eye that it's an apple. So one of my senses is saying it looks like an apple. And then I walk over to it and I pick it up. And if it weighs about the right amount, then I have two reasons for believing it's an apple. And then if you're, you know, not in a hurry to eat it, you might put it close to your nose and have a bit of a sniff, and you think, yeah, it smells like an apple. So three reasons for believing it's an apple. And then you sink your teeth in it, and it makes that beautiful crunching sound. You can hear it with your ears. You can taste it, and it's safe to eat because it's an apple. And so the more senses that it appeals to, the more you're going to have faith in it. But the faith that saves us goes beyond this. It's supernatural. And God knows that because it is beyond our physical senses that we need some help in understanding and believing. You know, he's no fool. He knows that we need that. And so he gets involved in the process supernaturally and gives us the Holy Spirit so that we can see and understand the truth that he wants to get across. And there's nothing more exciting than that. It is the most beautiful thing that a human being can encounter. It is life-changing. And that's what Paul discovered, and having discovered it, he wants others to do likewise. And so it's this supernatural faith that gives the gospel its power. And that's why Paul says he's not ashamed of it. He refuses to hold back, because he knows that it works for those who are prepared to accept it. And he won't let non-believers cause him to feel ashamed of it. And so we have lots of people in our community who go into the schools every week. They've been doing it for years. I myself have been doing it for 22 years. We go into the schools. We talk to the children about the gospel. We know that not all the children are going to accept it. And we know that some of the classes that are appalling are six classes I've got at the moment are the most cynical bunch I've had for a very long time. It can be very discouraging and all of that. But why do we keep doing it? We keep doing it because we know that there will be some who believe. And because there are some who believe, the gospel will have an enormous effect on their lives. It will completely change their lives for all eternity. And it's worth the trouble. And that's exactly the way Paul felt. So that brings us to this really famous verse then, verse 17 and onwards. And I'll read to you from the NIV, and then I'll read to you what I think is a better translation of it. So it says this: in the gospel, a righteousness from God is revealed, a righteousness that is by faith from first to last, just as it is written, the righteous will live by faith. Now, I think a better reading would be this. For in it, or in the gospel, the righteousness of God is revealed from faith to faith, instead of first to last. As it is written, the righteous will live by faith. And this, of course, is the verse that Martin Luther discovered. And it's interesting, as you look at Martin Luther's life, how similar in many ways it was to Paul's. You know, they both struggled to try and find satisfaction with God through their own efforts. You know, to an enormous degree, they overexerted themselves almost in religion and good works in order to find satisfaction with God, and could not find it. But in that struggle, they came, you know, they didn't give up in a sense, and finally this passage hit it, you know, really did it for Martin Luther. And he says this, he said, "At last, meditating day and night by the mercy of God, I began to understand that the righteousness of God," which before he saw as just being a big axe over his head, "the righteousness, you've got to meet the righteousness of God, you've got to do it in your own energies and strength and through religious observance. But he said, "I came to understand that the righteousness of God is that through which the righteous live by a gift of God, namely by faith. And here I felt as if I were entirely born again and entered paradise itself through the gates that have been flung open." So let's just go through this then. It's an incredibly important verse, and we're going to see more and more explanations of this as we go through Romans. So the question is, what is the righteousness of God? The righteousness of God is the perfection that you need to achieve in order to go to heaven. It's the standard that God expects of all people that he will receive into heaven, into eternity. But the next thing is, how is it revealed in a useful way to us? Well, it is revealed by Jesus Christ. He lives the perfect life that we were meant to live. In other words, he lives the righteousness of God. And we see that again in Romans chapter 3, and we'll come again to that later on. Paul in Romans chapter 3, starting at about verse 9, goes on to describe the hopelessness of mankind. Goes all the way through. He then goes and tells us that it's absolutely useless for us to try and obey the law in order to satisfy God. And then he says this. He says, but now a righteousness from God apart from the law, that is, put the law aside, we now have another righteousness from God, has been made known, to which the law and the prophets testify. In other words, to what the Old Testament testifies, the Old Testament points to. Verse 22, this righteousness from God comes through faith in Jesus Christ to all who believe. And so, what is the righteousness of God that's revealed? It is the life of Jesus, the perfect life of Jesus. The next question, he says, of course, that the righteous shall live by faith, but who are these people who are righteous? Who are they? Are they people who have lived righteous lives? No, no. They are people who will be declared righteous because they have faith in the one who was truly righteous. Okay. In other words, the righteousness of Jesus is credited as a free gift to those who are prepared to trust him. Easy peasy. Too easy, really, isn't it? It's not a bad deal. Okay? Now, what does it mean, though, when he says, from faith to faith? You know, this is where this is the hub of it, in a sense. What does it mean, faith to faith? What it means is this, that the faith of Jesus, in other words, you could say Jesus lived the perfect life. Why did he live the perfect life? Because he had perfect faith in his Father God. Or if you like, he was perfectly faithful. In other words, at no stage in his life did he lack faith in God. And because he had that faith, he is righteous. Because he had that faith, he was morally perfect. That faith can be credited to us if we have faith in him. And so what Paul is saying is that when we put our faith in Jesus, we get credited with his faith. And so we will be treated as though we have been perfectly faithful all of our lives. You see? Very powerful, isn't it? Now, final question. Are you all happy with that? Okay, so the final thing then is, why does it have to be by faith? Well, partly I've answered that because everything is by faith. You do everything by faith in a sense. But in this case, it's even more powerful. You see, it's got to be by faith because we are totally helpless when it comes to these issues, you see. I love this passage in John. It's so often read at funerals but never explained. It's John chapter 14, and it says this, Let your hearts be troubled. But don't be worried. That's what he's saying. Jesus is about to leave the disciples. He's about to die. He's about to go back to heaven with God. And he says, don't let your hearts be troubled. Don't be worried about the fact that I'm leaving. He said, trust in God. Trust also in me. And then he goes on to explain why they should trust. Very powerful. He says, in my Father's house are many rooms. In other words, there's plenty of room. We won't run out of room for you. And if it were not so, I would have not told you. In other words, I'm not here to tell lies to you. I only ever tell you what is true. I wouldn't tell you that there was plenty of room if there wasn't plenty of room. You see? Then he goes on. He says, I'm going to prepare a place for you. And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come back and take you to be with me so that you also may be where I am. Now, here's the question you have to ask yourself. You don't need Jesus, number one, if you can prepare your own place in eternity. Could any of you even imagine what you would like? So you can have what you can imagine you'd like, or you can have what God's going to give you. I know what's going to turn out the best. That's the first thing. Now, here's the next one. If you can get that one done, the next one might be really easy for you. Can you get yourself out of the grave? Anyone good at that? And having got yourself out of the grave, can you get yourself to where God is? Now, here's a really big one. When you get to God's doorstep and you knock on his door and he opens it, can you, on the basis of your own life, be certain that he's going to welcome you in? Nobody. So you're pretty helpless, aren't you? So the faith that I must have in Jesus is almost the same as the faith I must have in the pilot of an aeroplane if I decide to take a flight somewhere overseas. You see, I have to. I have to trust the pilot and perhaps the aeroplane as well. And the interesting thing is that if I decide that I'd like to contribute somehow, go into the cockpit and help the pilot, the chances are I would endanger not only my own life, but everybody else on the plane. In other words, I'm totally incapable of flying a Jumbo 7 whatever. Totally incapable. So I have to just sit in the plane and trust that the pilot and the creator of the plane know exactly what they're doing, because I am totally helpless when it comes to that. In the same way as I am totally helpless when it comes to my own salvation. So that's the first thing. The second thing, we are morally bankrupt. In other words, the longer we live, the deeper in debt we become. And we need to be bailed out by someone who is morally rich. And that's Jesus, who lived the perfect life. He can give us his perfect life, credit the things that he's earned, if you like, and get us out of moral bankruptcy. The third thing is that when I turn up to God's doorstep with anything less than the righteousness of God, I would be turned away. It would be hopeless, because I have a debt over my head that I can never pay. And he will not let debtors in to his heaven under any circumstances. And finally, of course, it glorifies God. Because the only way this is going to work, this new universe, is if everyone sees and appreciates the incredible significance of God. That's what glorifying him means. And also the incredible significance of Jesus. And their wisdom to know exactly what is best for every single person, their ability to unite every single person, and their ability to transform us all so that we can live in harmony together. So there's four reasons why it has to be by faith. So it's a very powerful thing. I remember some years ago, a couple came to me. Both of them were Roman Catholics. One of them was very dedicated to a Roman Catholicism. The other one was a bit kind of every now and again-ish. And they came to me because they wanted to be married, and both of them had been divorced before, and the Roman Catholic Church wouldn't allow for remarriage. And so they came to me. They were already living together, so I thought that I could improve their situation no end by, first of all, sharing the gospel with them, but also remarrying them. And so I insisted that I wouldn't remarry them unless they were prepared to do a series of studies so they would understand who God is, so that when they made promises in church, they knew what kind of God they were making the promises to. It was a very interesting experience. The first three studies, this woman particularly, was pretty aggressive, didn't like what I said that you haven't taught me anything new. You know, it was pretty hard going. And just about every week she said, I'm not going back to that bloke again. But the husband said, no, we've made this promise, we'll go through it, you know, agony though it is, we'll go through it and we'll get there. And on the fourth study, we talked about grace. You are saved, you know, by grace, through faith. This is not of your own doing. It is a gift from God. And it was like as if heaven had opened up in my office. Suddenly, it all made sense to her. And her and her husband had been going to a Presbyterian church. Where else would you go? In Dubbo ever since, you know. So if you have any doubts at all, you know, this is what God offers you. It's free. It's where you find meaning for your life. It's where you find love. It's where you find hope. And he loves you and wants to give it to you. but he cannot give it to you if you think you're silly enough to think you can do it for yourself. Let's pray.